My wife was just talking this afternoon about ordering a movie for tonight, and she wanted what kind of movie. And I like action adventure that's a romantic comedy, all right? And it's clean and all those kinds of things. But I love action adventure because then you can sit on the edge of your seat and wonder what's going to happen. Indiana Jones, for example, where you have Harrison Ford, you know, he gets into these real bad situations, and all of a sudden you think there is absolutely no hope that he's ever going to get out of it. And somehow the whole thing turns around. And he gets out of it and he wins and he moves on to the next thing. He gets in greater problem. You think there's no hope for him. He turns it around and he moves on. Don't you just love that? I always sit there and wonder, he's not going to get out of this one, and somehow I know he will. How do I know he's going to get out of it? I'd hate a movie where the hero didn't make it, right? They better never make a movie like that. You're not supposed to make movies like that. The hero always gets out of it. In fact, when they don't, they're very sad. When the hero dies in the end, right? But we know he's going to get out of it because that's how you write movies. When you come to the program of God, sometimes it seems like the people of God have really come to the end of the rope. It really seems like there is no hope for them. There's absolutely no way that they could possibly reverse this situation. And yet, as you go through the scriptures, you see again and again that which is often designed to destroy them turns around and destroys the one who was to destroy them. And somehow you understand, you always expect them to get out of it. You always expect them to win, even if it just means going to heaven. When you come to Esther, it's all about that. And we have understood there are three puzzling items in this book. The silence of God. Why is there no reference to God? No words from God? No revelation from God? Where's God? But that's an important thing. Hopefully you understand why. The slaughter of the 75,000, actually 75,800 people were slaughtered. And that's a real problem. In fact, I was reading the commentary in the Tyndale commentary series this afternoon, and Joyce Marshall, I think, is the author of that particular one. And she says, this is the passage that gives us the Christians the greatest trouble in all of life. Because how could God ever encourage the slaughter of 75,800 innocent people? And so we have to deal with that. Is that really a problem for us? And finally, the state or the condition of Mordecai and Esther. As we've been going through the book, you understand the first half, the great danger. They are a people who live under a pagan king. They live as part of an evil system, chapter 2. It's extremely evil. Everything about chapter 2 just makes you sick. And they're a part of it. They're actually in the middle of it all. And somehow they have to live in the midst of this pagan and evil system. They lived with the hatred of Haman in chapter 3. All of a sudden there's this hero, I should say, who comes along when he's not a hero. He's a villain. In chapter 4, they live under the sentence of death. There is no hope. So they ultimately come to realize they are going to die. There's a decree that cannot be returned or removed by the king that they will die. They'll be annihilated. And finally, they're living needing the favor of the king. The only hope is for them to go forward with the king. And so we have seen that. We have also seen that this book turns around and the great danger turns into a great deliverance in chapter 6 and chapter 7. It's all about Mordecai. And Mordecai is the one whose humiliation is turned to honor in chapter 6, whose death is turned to life. The one that was to die in the gallows turns around and kills somebody on the gallows. The gallows that were meant for him are actually turned around on him. And when you come to chapter 8, here's the words. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. And so the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. And suddenly, Mordecai has all these reversals in his life. It looked like he was going to die within 24 hours on the gallows that are 75 foot tall by the man who is empowered and has all the right to do that. Turns all around. He is honored. He is given life. Suddenly, the one who was going to lose it all is given possession of it all. By the way, that was common law in those days, that if there was an enemy and he was defeated or destroyed, then all of his goods went to the person who was most impacted by what he had been doing. So it was right for the king to give it to Esther and to her uncle, Mordecai. And so the one who was to lose it all is giving all the possession of it all. And finally, in chapter 8 and verse 2, the one who was going to be living in ruin and destruction is given a ring. And you understand that suddenly the whole thing has turned around for the individual. We studied that last week. But what about the nation? Because the immediate problem was within 24 hours, a man by the name of Mordecai is going to die. That's all been turned around. Everything about his life has been turned around. Him and Haman are in opposite spots. One is alive, the other is dead. It wasn't supposed to end that way. But what about the nation? Because it was a 12-month sentence. In 12 months, the decree was made. You remember in chapter 3 that it was sent throughout all the land by all the messengers to the 127 provinces, and anybody who wanted to could take on a Jew, destroy the Jew. In fact, it says annihilate and kill and destroy, take all of his property for himself. What an incentive to kill Jews. And in 12 months now, this is going to happen. In fact, some of that time has already gone. What will happen to them? But I think our hearts have already been prepared for this great reversal for the nation of Israel. Here's what it says in verse 3. Now Esther spoke again to the king. One of the themes of this book, there's all kinds of subplots and themes, is the times she comes to the king. And you've caught that. There'll be five times. If the first two go together, there are actually four times that she will come to the king with a request. We've already seen those first two or three, depending on how you look at it. And the first one, you expected her to do something. She said, would you come to a banquet? What did she need in a banquet? She was going to die and her uncle was going to die. What are you talking about? She asked for a very small thing. She asked if he will come to the banquet. You understand that in chapter 7, she asked if it can be turned around and the enemies removed for her uncle Mordecai. But now she is not done. She has to make another request. And every time she is at the mercy of the king. Every time she depends upon him, and every time she's dependent upon his favor, which is an important theme of this book. If you're going to ask, you realize you are dependent. And if you're going to ask, you ask someone who has the power and the authority to do something about it. And if you're going to ask, you got to have their favor or you won't get it. And although there is no mention of God here, there is tremendous lessons in contrast between Esther going to the king and you and me going to the King of Kings. So the third request is going to take place in verse 3. And Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king. And for the third time she comes, and you would think by this time she'd have a little bit of an arrogance about her. You might even think she'd have a little confidence about her. For some reason you think, well, I'm just going to saunter into the king. He's done it twice before. He's held out the scepter twice before. He's extended favor to me twice before. I'm his favorite queen. He likes my uncle Mordecai. Everything's good, but she does not. She never, ever assumes she has the right to ask anything of the king of her land. She falls before him. She implores him. She waits for his scepter to come out. And finally, she makes a request. Her third request, each request gets bigger. And each request is more daring. And each request is more necessary for the ultimate survival of the people of Israel. And her request this time, with tears, is that the evil of Haman would be counteracted. Verse 5 says, and it says, and said, if it please the king. Notice the way she approaches the king in her life. It's all if. If it pleases the king. If I have found favor in your sight. And the thing seems right to the king. And I am pleasing in your eyes. Let it be written. And she asks that the letters of Haman be revoked. You understand? She knew the law of the king could not be revoked. In fact, later on in chapter 8, he would say that. In fact, I think it's in chapter 8 and verse 6. It says, for how can I endure to see the evil that comes to the people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? Verse 8, you yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews at the end of that verse. And I've sealed with the king's signet. No one can revoke it. And she understands the law cannot be changed. The law that said in chapter 3, you have the right to go out and kill Jews on this specific day for 24 hours and take anything that is theirs. But the letters of Haman, that's a different story. Because you remember in chapter 3, it wasn't just the law of the king, it was the letters of Haman. Because Haman took upon himself an authority beyond that of the king. And he had sent letters to the 127 provinces and to all the satraps and governors and all those things. And in his letter, he had instilled in them this fear that if you do not do that, I, the prominent within the kingdom, I, who is number two in the kingdom, will not be happy with you. And so suddenly she asked, and she asked very carefully for this reversal. You understand exactly what happens in verse 5, devised by Haman, the son of Hammedat, the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who were or are in all the king's provinces. How can I endure to see the evil that will come on my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? And then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. And you yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews, as you please, in the king's name. Seal it with the king's signet ring. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is a month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, the princes of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, to the Jews in their own script and language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by the couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses bred with the swift steeds. And by these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together, to protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. You understand as you read that, there's a huge reversal that has taken place. And the letter of Haman, or the letters of Haman, are indeed revoked by the letters that are made by Mordecai. In fact, when you read verse 8 and verse 9, you have read that before, almost word for word, in chapter 3. There are only a few differences. In chapter 3, it was Haman, to whom the king said all those words and did all the same things and had all the same authority. It was just a different letter at the end of the day. And suddenly Mordecai has all of that power, all the same power, and the letters go out in his name. It goes swiftly. It goes rapidly. Now, as I said, this has caused people a lot of problems. Because later on we're going to read how the Jews will take advantage of this. On the day that's appointed for them, they will indeed kill. In fact, in chapter 9, the king will hear the report that on this day, 500 people were killed in his own palace. And he goes, I knew you were going to defend yourself, but I mean, 500 in my own house. And he's shocked. And Esther's going to have to come with another one. This has caused great, great problems to people. How could God's people slaughter these people? In fact, it says children and women. In fact, read down on that day, verse 12, in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, in which is the month of Adar, a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published for all people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Now all of a sudden God's people are allowed to avenge themselves. They are empowered to kill women and children and men. And they are allowed to plunder all that is taken. And suddenly this causes some problems for people. Why would God's people ever do those things? Didn't we have in the scriptures the truth that God avenges? Did we not have in the scripture where to love our enemies? What is this all about? Is this not just the killing of women and kids? How could this be? Well, before we answer that, let's read the rest of the story. Verse 14, the couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened and pressed on by the king's command. And the decree was issued in Shusha, the palace or the citadel. And Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel, blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shusha rejoiced and was glad. And the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and city where the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. And then many of the people of the land became Jews. This, by the way, is the first reference in the scriptures of people becoming Jews, non-Jews becoming proselytes and joining the Jewish people. And here is why. Because fear of the Jews fell on them. We're going to get to the point of why they were allowed to kill 75,800 people and whether that was a bad thing, an avenging thing or not. But maybe the thing we learn here as we read in chapter 8 is simply this. What seemed irrevocable, a decree of the Medes and the Persians, could not be turned around. And it couldn't. But the letters of Haman could. And they were. And suddenly, the children of Israel, who seemed for sure doomed, suddenly have hope. In fact, the end of this chapter was joy and gladness and honor and fear and a whole bunch of other things which we will get to. But maybe we'll just camp there with this first point. The decree, the letters were revoked. Against all odds, it can't happen, but it did. It did indeed happen. But the fact that it happened really doesn't tell us, or this decree is reversed, doesn't tell us that the children of Israel were really saved. Just because the law has changed, one part of that law has changed, and really the only part that was changed is this. You as a Jews have the right to gather and to defend. If you are attacked, if anyone comes at you, you can take out the sword and take them out. You are allowed to defend yourself. But will it really happen? Will the decree, which has been revoked, lead to a destruction that is reversed? And so we have chapter 9. In the 12th month, and that is the month of Adar, and you know this is the third time we found this now in Esther, because Haman, you remember, he had cast the lots, thrown the stones, he had done the Purim, and as he had cast the lots, it had been determined on this 12th month and the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar, that they were going to have the decree that they were allowed to kill the Jewish people. And so the law that Mordecai writes is on that same day, and now it's that day. In the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. And on that day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But the opposite occurred. In that, the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in their cities. Remember, they were allowed to do that. Apparently, before that, it was against the law to gather as a Jewish people in a Jewish place. But now they were allowed to do that. They gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. They were allowed to defend themselves. If you're attacked, you're allowed to strike back. My dad had a deal with me as a kid, as you know, and one of the things that kids do is fight. And he didn't mind it if I defended myself, but he didn't like it if I started the fight, especially with my brother. And so he had a little statement that said this, and I said, well, I was just preemptive. I didn't use that word because I wasn't smart enough to use that word, but sometimes we have to be preemptive, you know. We have to hit first because I know he's going to hit me, and I would say it that way. And my dad had the little statement, every dog has the right to bite first. And when the dog bites you, then you can hit him. But until he bites you, you can't do anything with him. Until your brother hits you, you can't hit him back. And so we understood that, and we understand that's exactly what's going there. The Jews were not empowered to kill people. They were empowered to defend themselves. And if you attack me with a sword, then I have the right to take you out with a sword. Every dog has the right to bite first. No preemptive strikes. Not in God's program here. And here's what happened. And all the officials, well, let's read the end of verse 2. The Jews gathered together. No one would withstand them because fear of them fell upon all the people. What a change has happened. The fear of Haman, the fear of the evil men has been changed to the fear of Mordecai and the fear of the Jews. And we understand, remember when we studied earlier, that even the king's wife knew who the Jews were. And she said, boy, if the Jews are the ones you're attacking, there is no hope for you. Remember, we studied that last week, because the Jews are the people of Jehovah. And the fear of the Jews and the fear of their God, people had learned in history, you do not touch Jewish people, because in the end, you will not win. In fact, I said this last week, I think it was, and maybe it's in here somewhere. I said, did you ever read all the history of the times the Jews have been attacked? Have you done that? And you can read it in Zion's Hope or Israel, My Glory. And these are all the dates you can see on the side here. I'm sure you can see it from there. Maybe you can't. But anyway, all the dates of all the attacks, page after page, of throughout history where the Jewish people have been attacked, many of them murdered and persecuted and killed. But in the end, nobody has ever won and destroyed them. And the people in the days of King Ahasuerus knew that. And for fear of the Jewish people, instead of opposing them, they stood with them. In fact, it says in verse 3, all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews because of the fear of Mordecai, which fell upon them. And Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For this man, Mordecai became increasingly prominent. And the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. And in Susa, the palace of the citadel, the Jews killed, destroyed 500 men. And he lists some of them there, who are the 10 sons of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. They killed, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. And on that day, the number of those who were killed in Susa, the citadel, were brought to the king. The king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in the capital and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? This is outlandish. I can't believe it. In my own house, 500. If you got 500 in my house, I wonder what's happened throughout all the rest of the provinces. And Esther has to go to the king for the fourth request, because she knows it isn't done. In 24 hours, they haven't finished it. And so now she's going to ask her greatest request. And on this one, the king might not be favorably inclined, because he's already come to her and said, what are your Jewish people doing? How could you kill 500 in my own house? Here's what she says. Verse 13. If it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Susa to do again tomorrow, according to today's decree. And let Haman's 10 sons, who are already dead, be hanged on the gallows. And the king commanded this to be done. And the decree was issued in Susa, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. And the Jews who were in Susa gathered together again on the 14th day of the month and killed 300 men. But they did not lay a hand on the plunder. And the remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives and the rest from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of their enemies, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day of the month they rested and made it a day of fasting, a feasting, and gladness. You understand, there's a great reversal. The letters are revoked. But that's not enough. You can stop the enemy, but if you don't wipe them out, they're always there. And Esther knew that. As long as they're there, we might win today, but they'll be here tomorrow. And the day will come, they'll be back. So she bravely asks for another day. And God graciously allows it through the heart and life of King Ahasuerus. And 75,800 enemies are destroyed. Now, as I said, many people see this as a problem. Ellicott, the great commentator, says, the Jews who were now in control did worse than those who had been in control over them, which is often common in history, is it not? The ones who are persecuted, once they're given power, persecute worse than the ones that persecuted them. He said this, they needlessly butchered men, women, and children, and they hung on the gallows 10 men who were already dead. It is a senseless slaughter of uncontrolled revenge. But is it? Does that bother you? Is that what's really being communicated? I think there are several things that make me feel a little more comfortable with what they did. Here are some things. They only destroyed the enemies who attacked. It's only self-defense. They did not attack those who did not attack them. It is very clear in the record they only killed men. They did not kill women and children. And even though they were authorized to do that, remember the decree said you can kill even the kids and the ladies, they never did it. And they were also authorized to plunder, which was common in those days. If an enemy attacks you and takes you on, you have the right to defend yourself and take them out, and then whatever is theirs becomes yours. Three times in this record, it tells us they did not do that. And it was limited to only 2 days. And when it was done, they were done. You understand that it was simply a self-defense against those who attack. In fact, the real issue is this. It's amazing there were 75,800 people who attacked the Jews. Now, how dumb do you have to be? How brave, how brazen, how filled with hate do you have to be to take on the Jewish people who are now in the favor of the king, who has a person who's number two in command, who has the king's signet ring, who is writing letters and laws at will and given the authority to do that? How foolish would you be to take on the Jewish people? But there are 75,800 people who so hate the Jews, they take them on and the Jews destroy them. But what we know is the letters are revoked, and now the enemy is truly removed. God has given a great victory for the Jewish people. And the result of that, verse 18, the Jews who were at Shusha assembled together on the 13th day as well as on the 14th. On the 15th day, they rested and they made a day of feasting and gladness. You could read from verse 18 down to verse 32. They just rejoiced. Remember back in chapter 8, we had the same thing. Verse 15, he went out with his royal apparel, blue and white. Verse 15, great crown of gold. And the city of Susa rejoiced and was glad. Do you remember what happened when Haman made his decree? And again, you'd have to compare. Chapter 3, verse 13, 14, and 15 is where Haman writes the decree. He's given the authority to write the decree. He's given the signet ring, 127 provinces, on and on it goes. And the exact same word are now found in chapter 8 for Mordecai. And when it was all done and Haman had made the decree and had sent it out on swift post, what did the people do? It says in chapter 4, the people were filled with sorrow. The people were filled with sorrow. The nation was filled with sorrow that their leader was telling them to wipe out the Jewish people. And you know what happened when Mordecai gets to it and makes the decree and it's carried out? The people, that's what it says in verse 15, the city of Susa rejoiced and was glad. In fact, the Jews were light, verse 16 of chapter 8, gladness, joy, honor. Every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness and a feast and a holiday. And many of the people became Jews. The people who were both supposed to be destroyed and wiped out now are the people that people want to join. And they do because of fear. Something is happening to this group of people called the Jews that the world looks on and says, wow, don't mess with them. Wow, there's something special about them. And even though we're not sure that they understood it, as far as what was really going on behind the scenes, the fear of the Jewish people became a strong fear and they wanted to join them. You could read in chapter 9 this great passage, the Jews feasting in gladness. We won't take the time. You understand, let's go to verse 26. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur. And one of the great feasts of the Jewish people is the Feast of Purim. Pur, as you know, means lots, or the casting of lots. It's found in chapter 4, where Haman is the right to make the law. And it says, well, okay, he says, what day were we going to wipe these Jewish people out? And so they cast the lots, it said. And what he had done by casting the lots now is turned around. And so they're going to celebrate the casting of the lots of Haman, which was a reminder that they were not successful and the Jewish people were. And so the nation is reversed and delivered because the letter is revoked, the enemies are removed, and the joy is restored. And there's gladness, not only for them, but for all the people. And then there's one last thing. Chapter 10, King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the land and on the islands of the sea. Now, all the acts of his power and his might and the account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, Are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of the Medes and the Persians? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus and was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good, or the prosperity, literally, of his people, and speaking peace, or shalom, to all his countrymen. You see, when it was all returned or reversed, and God's man is now in authority, the people are happy. There's joy in the land. But more than that, the reason these three verses are given to show how successful the king has become, with Mordecai leading him versus Haman leading him, his great acts, his mighty power, all those things are listed. Here's a pagan, drunken king who turns over much of the rule of his land to a man by the name of Mordecai, who is a Jew, and he prospers. And things go well. And in fact, it closes with those great words, Mordecai the Jew seeks the prosperity of his people and brings peace, or shalom, to all his countrymen. You understand the difference between prosperity, or doing well, and peace, the Jewish word, the Hebrew word shalom, which we've studied before. The word shalom means circle, means complete, means whole, means well, it means sound, it means all that it's supposed to be. And that's why the Jewish people to this day say, shalom. I want your life to be the life that is sound and well and whole and complete and all that it's supposed to be. Which means you don't have conflict, that's true, but much more than that. It means it's going well. In fact, it would be the word that we would use when we use the word welfare. Now, I understand welfare to us somehow means what the government gives to people. But really, the word welfare means to fare well. And Mordecai the Jew brings prosperity. The land is doing well. But he also brings wellness, soundness to the land, and there is a peace. You understand the great deliverance resulted in the letters revoked, and the enemies are removed. Amazingly, 75,800 of them hated the Jews that bad, they actually took them on. The joy is restored, and the prosperity results. We need to finish up next week, and we'll be done with the book of Esther. So why is there no mention of God? And why do we have no evidence that Esther or Mordecai ever prayed, ever looked to God? Why is there no evidence of that, no statement of that? What's really going on, and what can we learn? Maybe tonight we'll just learn this. As you look at the request of Esther, they teach you something about making a request to those who are in authority over you, to your king. She starts out small. She knows when she walks into the king, I do not have the right to be here. He can throw me out in a second. He can kill me if he wants to. I'm going to start out small. Would you come to a banquet? You know why? She knows she needs his favor. If he is not favorably disposed to her, he's not going to give her anything. And she will make her way up and talk about her uncle Mordecai. Could we turn around that one? He gives it to her. She will then say, what about the decree that has gone out? Would we deal with that? And he gives it to her. And finally, even though that's been taken care of, we saw that the enemy had not been completely removed. And she bravely asked for a second day, because the task was not done, and he gave it to her. And it's a lesson to you and to me about what it takes to ask. You have no right to ask the king anything. And if he is not in favor of you, you probably aren't going to get it. And as you read that, it's not the similarities of that passage to our great God and King, but the contrast. She walked in with fear. She started out small. I got to work him up. I got to gain his heart. Make him happy with it. I'll keep feeding him and dining him. And do you know what we can do? We can walk boldly in front of the throne of grace to find help in time of need. And the first moment you walk in, you can ask for whatever you want. And you do not have to gain his favor, because he already have shown you favor in your life. God help us to understand, and next week we'll put it all together. At least today, this great reversal, the great change. When it looked the bleakest, Mordecai is going to be dead in 24 hours. The entire nation of Israel will be wiped out in 12 months. The thing turned around. Mordecai goes to the top, and the nation of Israel wins the hearts of the people. God can turn it all around. Let's pray. Father, what a wonderful privilege it is to be your child. We often find ourselves in those spots that seem impossible. There's no way out of this one. And we know that you can reverse it if you so please. And help us to think even this week about why your name's not written in this book, why there's no evidence of any prayer or godliness. Help us to understand the real purpose of this book and the real message of this book. And we'll thank you for that, for we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.